Part 3. The First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Laws enacted to control or suppress speech may operate at different points in the speech process. The following are just a few examples of restrictions that have been attempted at different stages of the speech process, all laws found to be invalid. Restrictions requiring a permit at the outset, imposing a burden by impounding proceeds on receipts or royalties, seeking to exact a cost after the speech occurs, and subjecting the speaker to criminal penalties. The law before us is an outright ban backed by criminal sanctions. Section 441B makes it a felony for all corporations, including nonprofit advocacy corporations, either to expressly advocate the election or defeat of candidates, or to broadcast electioneering communications within 30 days of a primary election and 60 days of a general election. Thus, the following acts would all be felonies under Section 441B. The Sierra Club runs an ad within the crucial phase of 60 days before the general election that exhorts the public to disapprove of a congressman who favors logging in national forests. The National Rifle Association publishes a book urging the public to vote for the challenger because the incumbent U.S. senator supports the handgun ban. The American Civil Liberties Union creates a website telling the public to vote for a presidential candidate in light of that candidate's defense of free speech. These prohibitions are classic examples of censorship. Section 441D is a ban on corporate speech, notwithstanding the fact that a PAC created by a corporation can still speak. A PAC is a separate association from the corporation. So, the PAC exemption from Section 441B's expenditure ban does not allow corporations to speak. Even if a PAC could somehow allow a corporation to speak, and it does not, the option to form PACs does not alleviate the First Amendment problems with Section 441B. PACs are burdensome alternatives. They are expensive to administer and subject to extensive regulations. For example, every PAC must appoint a treasurer, forward donations to the treasurer promptly, keep detailed records of the identities of the persons making donations, preserve receipts for 3 years, and file an organizational statement and report changes to this information within 10 days. And that's just the beginning. PACs must file detailed monthly reports with the FEC, which are due at different times depending on the type of election that is about to occur. These reports must contain information regarding the amount of cash on hand, the total amount of receipts, detailed by 10 different categories, the identification of each political committee and candidate's authorized or affiliated committee making contributions, and any persons making loans, providing rebates, refunds, dividends, or interest, or any other offset to operating expenditures in an aggregate amount over $200, the total of all disbursements detailed by 12 different categories, the names of the authorized or affiliated committees to whom expenditures aggregating over $200 have been made, persons to whom loan repayments or refunds have been made, the total of all contributions, operating expenses, outstanding debts and obligations, and the settlement terms of the retirement of any debt or obligation. PACs have to comply with these regulations just to speak. This might explain why fewer than 2,000 of the millions of the corporations in this country have PACs. PACs, furthermore, must exist before they can speak. Given the onerous restrictions, a corporation may not be able to establish a PAC in time to make its views known regarding candidates and issues in a current campaign. Section 441B's prohibition on corporate independent expenditures is thus a ban on speech. As a restriction on the amount of money a person or group can spend on political communication during a campaign, that statute necessarily reduces the quantity of expression by restricting the number of issues discussed, the depth of exploration, and the size of the audience reached. Were the court to uphold these restrictions, the government could repress speech by silencing certain voices at any of the various points in the speech process. If Section 441B applied to individuals, no one would believe that it is merely a time, place, or manner restriction on speech. Its purpose and effect are to silence entities whose voices the government deems to be suspect. Speech is an essential mechanism of democracy, for it is the means to hold officials accountable to the people. The right of citizens to inquire, to hear, to speak, and to use information to reach consensus is a precondition to enlightened self-government and a necessary means to protect it. The First Amendment has its fullest and most urgent application to speech uttered during a campaign for political office. For these reasons, political speech must prevail against laws that would suppress it, whether by design or inadvertence. Laws that burden political speech are subject to strict scrutiny, which requires the government to prove that the restriction furthers a compelling interest and is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. While it might be maintained that political speech simply cannot be banned or restricted as a categorical matter, the quoted language from WRTL provides a sufficient framework for protecting the relevant First Amendment interests in this case. We shall employ it here. Premised on mistrust of governmental power, the First Amendment stands against attempts to disfavor certain subjects or viewpoints. Prohibited, too, are restrictions distinguishing among different speakers, allowing speech by some but not others. As instruments to censor, these categories are interrelated. Speech restrictions based on the identity of the speaker are all too often simply a means to control content. Quite apart from the purpose or effect of regulating content, moreover, the government may commit a constitutional wrong when by law it identifies certain preferred speakers. By taking the right to speak from some and giving it to others, the government deprives the disadvantaged person or class of the right to use speech to strive to establish worth, standing, and respect for the speaker's voice. The government may not by these means deprive the public of the right and privilege to determine for itself what speech and speakers are worthy of consideration. The First Amendment protects speech and speaker and the ideas that flow from each. The court has upheld a narrow class of speech restrictions that operate to the disadvantage of certain persons. But these rulings were based on an interest in allowing governmental entities to perform their functions. The corporate independent expenditures at issue in this case, however, would not interfere with governmental functions, so these cases are inapposite. These precedents stand only for the proposition that there are certain governmental functions that cannot operate without some restrictions on particular kinds of speech. By contrast, it is inherent in the nature of the political process that voters must be free to obtain information from diverse sources in order to determine how to cast their votes. At least before Austin, the court had not allowed the exclusion of a class of speakers from the general public dialogue. We find no basis for the proposition that in the context of political speech, the government may impose restrictions on certain disfavored speakers. Both history and logic lead us to this conclusion. Section A, subsection 1. The court has recognized that First Amendment protection extends to corporations. This protection has been extended by explicit holdings to the context of political speech. Under the rationale of these precedents, political speech does not lose First Amendment protection simply because its source is a corporation. The court has thus rejected the argument that political speech of corporations or other associations should be treated differently under the First Amendment simply because such associations are not natural persons. At least since the latter part of the 19th century, the laws of some states and of the United States imposed a ban on corporate direct contributions to candidates. Yet not until 1947 did Congress first prohibit independent expenditures by corporations and labor unions in Section 304 of the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947. In passing this act, Congress overrode the veto of President Truman, who warned that the expenditure ban was a dangerous intrusion on free speech. For almost three decades thereafter, the court did not reach the question whether restrictions on corporate and union expenditures was constitutional. The question was in the background of United States versus CIO, 1948. There, a labor union endorsed a congressional candidate in its weekly periodical. The court stated that the gravest doubt would arise in our minds as to the federal expenditure prohibition's constitutionality if it were construed to suppress that writing. The court engaged in statutory interpretation and found the statute did not cover the publication. Four justices, however, said they would reach the constitutional question and invalidate the Labor Management Relations Act's expenditure ban. The concurrence explained that any undue influence generated by a speaker's large expenditures was outweighed by the loss for democratic processes resulting from the restrictions upon free and full public discussion. In United States v. Automobile Workers, 1957, the court again encountered the independent expenditure ban, which had been recodified at 18 U.S. Code Section 610. After holding only that a union television broadcast that endorsed candidates was covered by the statute, the court refused to anticipate constitutional questions and remanded for the trial to proceed. Three justices dissented, arguing that the court should have reached the constitutional question and that the ban on independent expenditures was unconstitutional. Under our Constitution, it is we, the people, who are sovereign. The people have the final say. The legislators are their spokesmen. The people determine through their votes the destiny of the nation. It is therefore important, vitally important, that all channels of communication be open to them during every election, that no point of view be restrained or barred, and that the people have access to the views of every group in the community. The dissent concluded that deeming a particular group too powerful was not a justification for withholding First Amendment rights from any particular group, labor or corporate. The court did not get another opportunity to consider the constitutional question in that case, for after a remand, a jury found the defendants not guilty. Later, in Pipefitters v. United States, 1972, the court reversed a conviction for expenditure of union funds for political speech, again without reaching the constitutional question. The court would not resolve that question for another 4 years. Subsection 2. In Buckley v. Vallejo, 1976, the court addressed various challenges to the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971, FECA, as amended in 1974. These amendments created 18 U.S. Code Section 608E, an independent expenditure ban separate from Section 610 that applied to individuals as well as corporations and labor unions. Before addressing the constitutionality of Section 608E's independent expenditure ban, Buckley first upheld Section 608B, FECA's limits on direct contributions to candidates. The Buckley court recognized a sufficiently important governmental interest in the prevention of corruption and the appearance of corruption. This followed from the court's concern that large contributions could be given to secure a political quid pro quo. The Buckley court explained that the potential for a quid pro quo corruption distinguished direct contributions to candidates from independent expenditures. The court emphasized that the independent expenditure ceiling fails to serve any substantial governmental interest in stemming the reality or appearance of corruption in the electoral process, because the absence of prearrangement and coordination alleviates the danger that expenditures will be given as a quid pro quo for improper commitments from the candidate. Buckley invalidated Section 608E's restrictions on independent expenditures, with only one justice dissenting. Buckley did not consider Section 610's separate ban on corporate and union independent expenditures, the prohibition that also had been in the background in CIO, Automobile Workers, and Pipefitters. Had Section 610 been challenged in the wake of Buckley, however, it could not have been squared with the reasoning and analysis of that precedent. The expenditure ban invalidated in Buckley, Section 608E, applied to corporations and unions, and some of the prevailing plaintiffs in Buckley were corporations. The Buckley court did not invoke the First Amendment's overbreadth doctrine to suggest that Section 608E's expenditure ban would have been constitutional if it had applied only to corporations and not to individuals. Buckley cited with approval the Automobile Workers' dissent, which argued that Section 610 was unconstitutional. Notwithstanding this precedent, Congress recodified Section 610's corporate and union expenditure ban, the 2 U.S. Code Section 441B, 4 months after Buckley was decided. Section 441B is the independent expenditure restriction challenged here. Less than 2 years after Buckley, Bilotti reaffirmed the First Amendment principle that the government cannot restrict political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity. Bilotti could not have been clearer when it struck down a state law prohibition on corporate independent expenditures related to referenda issues. We thus find no support in the First Amendment or in the decisions of this court for the proposition that speech that otherwise would be within the protection of the First Amendment loses that protection simply because it sources a corporation that cannot prove to the satisfaction of the court a material effect on its business or property. That proposition amounts to an impermissible legislative prohibition of speech based on the identity of the interests that spokesmen may represent in public debate over controversial issues, and a requirement that the speaker have a sufficiently great interest in the subject to justify communication. In the realm of protected speech, the legislature is constitutionally disqualified from dictating the subjects about which persons may speak and the speakers who may address a public issue. It is important to note that the reasoning and holding of Bellotti did not rest on the existence of a viewpoint discriminatory statute. It rested on the principle that the government lacks the power to ban corporations from speaking. Bellotti did not address the constitutionality of the state's ban on corporate independent expenditures to support candidates. In our view, however, that restriction would have been unconstitutional under Bellotti's central principle that the First Amendment does not allow political speech restrictions based on a speaker's corporate identity.